Good afternoon. So, last time, we finished up talking about redo logging and file systems. One kind of important thing we mentioned when we were finishing up was that we had redo logging, like, let us make everything consistent, in the sense that if we had some abnormal shutdown, that we wouldn't have something weird about the state of our file system. But some file systems make the choice not to do this for everything because they're worried about the performance cost. So, for example, they might leave the data in files not consistent in this manner, but keep everything else with redo logging. Then we moved on to our second topic of distributed systems. And the idea of distributed systems is that we had sort of one common problem that a bunch of machines would work on together. We looked at sort of two very different models for organizing distributed systems, kind of extremes. So we had the client-server model, where we'd have these servers that would, you know, get requests from clients and send responses. The clients would kind of, you know, not be contacted directly, would only go to talk to the server, versus this peer-to-peer model where everyone does everything. Everyone's kind of equal. These seem like two extremes. We mentioned that in reality, we often sort of have something in between, or we have a mix, or sort of a combination of multiple instances of these models. So we mentioned with the client server, we often have a server that's a client for something else, so we have the sort of layers of a client server model. After looking at this high-level organization, we went back to our high-level question of, well, why would I use a distributed system? Like, why would I want to have multiple machines doing things together? We had sort of a bunch of very different categories of reasons. We mentioned that it might just be because we have multiple machines that are owned by different people, you know, because different people have, like, different data that we need to keep together, and we want to handle that differing control. Or it might be for technical reasons, like we might want to get better reliability by having redundancy, and you want to scale up a system by adding machines. Then we looked at, well, what are ways that machines communicate? We had these high-level models of how they would communicate, but we didn't talk about what the mechanics were of actually sending messages from one machine to the other. And we had these sort of two high-level models. We had this mailbox model. And the idea of the mailbox model is each machine has a sort of conceptual mailbox, and any machine could send, we'll say, a letter addressed to a machine, it would go in their mailbox, a program on that machine could pull it out of their mailbox. And each letter was kind of independent. And that's enough, but we wanted something a little more convenient. Sort of our first step of more convenient was this idea of connections. That rather than, you know, sending single letters, we'd want to arrange to have a connection, which you can think of kind of like a phone call between programs on two machines, where they could send messages, get replies back that are kind of tied to that connection, and send multiple messages in a row and have them all be tied together. And we mentioned, though we won't go into details, that you can implement the connection idea on top of the mailbox model. So once we had this connection abstraction, we wanted to look at, like, how would we actually use that? And we had two sorts of problems. So one was what the API was going to be. Get to that next. First problem was, well, how do we actually, like, say, I want to go to that machine? And we talked about the idea of names versus addresses for this. So we want to name a machine, and we've seen machine names on the web, so www.cs.virginia.edu is a machine name, but the actual underlying sort of mailbox model wants to use what we called addresses, which let us find the machine. And we learned that there was a mapping from names to addresses for the internet, and this, for machine names, this worked that we had this domain name system, which was a distributed system itself that got us from a name to an address, so we could actually, you know, talk to the right machine and have our routers, which only know about addresses because that's what's convenient for finding a particular machine, you know, let them work with that. And we also had other ideas of names versus addresses. You mentioned sort of examples from before, like a variable name versus a variable address. And we also had this with identifying a program on a machine that we needed to specify, you know, I'm going into this machine? Do I want to talk to the web server or the SSH server? And we had port numbers for this to identify programs. And port numbers are kind of an address. The corresponding name would be like HTTP or SSH. And we said with port numbers, we just had sort of a conventional mapping rather than a distributed database. So now that we have a way of identifying who we want to talk to with connections, we needed to have an actual interface for connections. And we mentioned the one that POSIX-like operating systems provide, which is sockets, where our connections would be file descriptors, sort of everything we've seen with POSIX. When in doubt, make something a file. That's what they did. And there'd be file descriptors, but we'd have some extra operations. So one of these operations was for servers, they needed to say, you know, where is someone going to connect to me? So there was a special call bind to set a local address where you'd expect to get connections. And with servers, we had a separate socket for getting connections to start versus actually using a connection. So there was a separate accept operation, which would get a new connection, but get a new file descriptor for it. The idea would be that every single connection had its own file descriptor, and a server could serve multiple clients. So it would call accept multiple times, get new file descriptors each time. On the client side, we needed a way to do the opposite of connect, in the sense of actually contacting a server and say, I'd like to make a new connection. And that call was called connect, where instead of making a new file descriptor, this would take our current file descriptor and transform it into something that was connected to the server. Once we did this setup, either accepting a connection or connecting from a client, we'd end up with a connection file descriptor that we could use like a two-directional pipe. We could just read and write from. So I'm going to finish up talking about sockets very quickly, and then we're going to look at a more abstract model of communication known as remote procedure calls. But before I do that, questions about things we covered last time. Okay. So at the end of last time, we had this sort of high-level view of how clients and servers act. And here's a version of that, but we've made a fix so we can have the server handle multiple connections at once. First, let's look at the client side for review. So on the client side, we're going to create a socket for the client. We're going to have to call, make this connect call to specify, hey, I know where the server is. I've been given the host name and port, and say to connect to it. And once that finishes, we can read and write until we're done. And on the server end, we're going to have to create what we called a server socket, which is kind of just a factory for connection sockets. And we'd set it up by saying, here's the host and port number clients are going to use by using this bind operation. And then we'd accept connections. And on the diagram I showed you last time, we accepted a connection, then reader wrote, then accepted the next connection. But really, we'd like to handle multiple connections at once. So what we can do, so probably the simplest thing, is we could accept a connection and then read and write from that connection, but we could do that in a new process or thread. And we could have one thread for connection do this, and this way we can handle multiple clients at a time. We could also, you know, use an event loop, as we briefly mentioned when we talked about event loops, to handle reading and writing from multiple connection sockets at once. And so that's sort of part of the reason why our accept operation gives us a new file descriptor, so we could have multiple active connections at once and have our server not be limited to one client at a time. For the client side, it doesn't make so much sense for connect to give us a new new file descriptor, because we probably just want to talk to one server at a time. So questions about this picture? So one thing we're kind of missing is, how do we specify the host and port name? And you remember we talked about names and addresses, and the POSIX connect and bind operations actually expect an address. So we need some way of going from the name to the address. And POSIX provides a utility for doing this called getAdderInfo. There's also a few older APIs, but this is what I recommend. And basically, this is a function whose only purpose is to take stuff a user might type in, like, you know, www.cs.virginia.edu and HTTPS, and convert that into the address plus port number. And it converts it into the form that bind or connect expect. And this is sort of that remaining, that little missing piece of how we make those bind and connect calls. Okay. So that's names and addresses. So we have our whole socket interface. And when I'm talking about this, I'm like looking at sort of stuff on the internet. And it seems like, gosh, we're talking about distributed systems, we're talking about using multiple machines. That's obviously what sockets are for, things like web browsers, web servers, you know, where we want to go to a remote machine. And that is like the most obvious use of sockets, but it turns out that this socket idea is actually really nice locally. And it's so important that POSIX and Unix-like OSs have a type of socket that only works in the local machine. You might say, why is this useful? Like, couldn't I just do something else in the local machine? It's just that the socket interface is convenient on the local machine. And so one example is on Linux, the program that actually puts things on the display is typically an independent program that acts as a server. So when I like start up a text editor that opens a window, it talks to this server to say, hey, I'd like to make a window. And if we have this client server model locally, we'd like to use a socket for that. That's sort of the interface we provide. So we have a local version of that. And as something to help support this, these special local sockets allow us to have, rather than a name and a port number, we can have a file on disk. So this kind of works the same way as device files. We mentioned that we have something that looks like a file, but actually is mapped to a particular thing that's connected to the machine. Here we'll have something that looks like a file. You can name it with a file, you can put it in a directory, but that's just used to map a name to the actual address inside the kernel. And partly I'm mentioning it because we're gonna have an assignment where we're gonna use a higher level abstraction called RPC, but that's going to be built on sockets. And we're going to want to test it locally without worrying about internet stuff. So we're going to use these local sockets for that, which is another nice use of them, is that if you don't want to like have something on the internet and test it, you can use this interface. But probably the most common use is that like there turns out that there's lots of sort of local servers that aren't part of the kernel, but are kind of important services that are often accessible this way. And I can see this with the netstat command. So I showed you netstat output last time to list all the internet connections on my machine. I can also list these Unix domain sockets. And we see I have a whole bunch of them when I ran this on my laptop. And it's not obvious what all of these are. So I happen to know this UDEV, for example, that is something which manages devices. So if a program wants to get configure devices or query devices, it makes a socket to this file and talks to that server. There's this server here, which is CUPS, is a print service. So when I want to print from a program, the way that works is that it opens up a connection to this server that's running locally that knows how to do printing and sends, hey, I'd like to print this through that socket. And here I mentioned that the display server like actually runs as this server. So the program that's actually displaying things, like other programs have to talk to it. They do it through this socket here on my laptop. questions. So any other... So this is where I'm going to finish up talking about sockets. So any questions about Unix domain sockets or sockets in general and that sort of model of how we run a server that handles multiple connections. Okay. Apparently not. So our next topic, as I said, is going to be at a higher level of abstraction. That sockets, they're a nice interface, but they still make talking to a remote machine sort of a very exotic operation. And we'd like something that looks kind of more natural. And one proposal that's actually pretty popular is an idea called remote procedure calls. The goal here is that I'm going to write a bunch of functions and I'm going to be able to call them on another machine. And the hope is that this is kind of what we'll call transparent, that there's going to be some tool and library that handles all the details. So these remote procedure calls, which we'll abbreviate RPCs, are going to look like a local procedure call. And I think this is the first time we're kind of explicitly talking about this idea of transparency, which is a very common thing you see when people are talking about distributed systems. So the idea of transparency with distributed systems is that we can see through the system being distributed, that it acts as if it's really local. So for RPC, we'd like it to be the case that these remote procedure calls look like local procedure calls, that I can't tell the difference between the two. You know, even though I'm going to another machine, you know, it looks the same. You know, there's some glass I'm going in through that I can see through, but it looks the same to me, and there should be no difference. And this is a great goal that, you know, that writing our local programs versus our distributed programs should be exactly the same. And it's a nice goal, but we'll see that we're going to have to make some compromises. We're not going to get. So I have this idea of remote procedure calls, and I'm, you know, sort of gave away the game is that we're going to have some tool and library that handles all the details. So the question is, what is that tool and library like together doing? And if we think about it, we want to have two operations. We want to be able to call a remote procedure like a local procedure, and we want to have at the remote end, us called as if it were a local procedure call. Now, the easiest way of doing this is to have a local procedure we call that accesses the remote machine. And this is what a typical RPC implementation is going to do. It's going to generate a local version of the procedure that stands in for the remote machine. It's going to have the same prototype as the thing on the remote machine, but rather than doing what the thing on the remote machine does, it's going to use some sockets to contact the remote machine and actually make the call happen. On the remote side, we want to write a normal function and just wait for it to be called. So we'll have another one of these stubs that stands in for the other machine that exists just to call that procedure. And I say we generate them because we want a different stub for every different procedure. We're going to use just a normal function call. And in fact, a typical implementation of this, especially for languages like C++, is we will literally generate a C++ source file, which has a function with the same prototype or something which makes a function call. That's going to stand in for the remote machine. Questions about this idea of stubs. So we have these stubs. So with that, how does this look? So our client program, which is making the remote procedure calls, is going to make a normal local function call. But rather than calling the server program directly, it's going to call this client stub. And generally, this client stub, there's going to be some compiler-like tool that generates this wrapper function. And in addition to receiving the function call, you know, having the right prototype, part of its job is going to be to take the arguments to that function, which, you know, it's going to be different for every function, and convert it to bytes. Why bytes? Because when we get here, this has to be bytes. That's what sockets want, so we have to get the arguments into bytes. We're also going to have to get a return value eventually, so this is going to need to convert the return value, which is going to be sent as bytes over the network here, back to the type the client program expects. So if you imagine like we're returning a, you know, passing a struct to the function, we need to somehow get that struct back into bytes and then get it back into a struct at, when we're done, for if we're returning it, for example. So we just, this is responsible for both having the right prototype so we can call it like a function and have it return, and also for dealing with converting the arguments into something that can go over the network. We have this RPC library, which is going to be responsible for actually setting up the network connection and so on. On the server end, this we're going to need to have another stub, and this contains an actual function call. And to make that function call, it's going to need to take the bytes that this client stub produced and convert them back to arguments. It's also going to need to do the reverse process on the return value of the actual function call. Now, I gave the impression that like this client sub just gets bytes for the arguments, sends them directly over the network, but that's not going to be quite enough. Remember that this is, we want this to be like, you know, having a library. So like kind of our idea is that I'd have a library where usually I just compile the library locally and link it locally, but now we have a library where the library is implemented on the server. And the library probably has multiple functions. So in addition to the actual arguments, we're going to need to somehow identify the function being called, and the RPC library is going to have some way of doing that. So it can figure out here which of the probably many server stubs it should be using. Okay. So it sends that back. Sends that over, it finds the right server stub, that makes the function call, it gets the return value, converts that back to bytes, and returns the result. It might also return a failure indication. For example, let's say we tried to call a remote procedure, but it wasn't there. Usually, with a local procedure call, we'd expect there to be a linker error, but with a remote procedure call, we don't have that linking step to detect that problem, so we get an error indication here, for example. Normally, we'd expect to just get our return value. Questions about this sort of data flow before we talk about sort of what this looks like from a code perspective? Okay, so I've talked about the hope that our remote procedure calls look just like local procedure calls and everything is great. And great, just, you know, we just magically get our things on the other machine, no extra effort. And now I'm going to show you some code from Google's RPC system, using Google's RPC system. I've chosen to use that because that's what we'll be using in an upcoming assignment, and because it's a real RPC system. But you might be a little miffed about how it corresponds to procedure calls. So here I have a client calling a make directory operation. And here's my server implementing that. This is just a function that calls makedir. The idea is we can make a directory on a remote machine. That's why we have this. And, you know, this is kind of like a function call, normal function call. This code is in Python, by the way. Yes, the last assignment will be in Python, which you think is probably easier for most people. But, you know, this looks a little more complicated than your normal Python function call. This looks a little more complicated than sort of the Python version of this function you would have made if all you needed to do was make the makedir wrapper. We'll talk about, like, why that stuff is there. Let's look at this. So here I have my client side this is the equivalent of this local call, and we see we have a bunch of junk that was added. Some of this, you know, is actually sort of necessary, and some of it is that gRPC has made some design choices where they said, well, I care more about things like working with multiple languages well and simplifying servers and clients than making this exactly look like a function call. This is the equivalent of this sort of procedure call. And at the server end, we've defined inside a class, we'll talk about that later, our directory function. And if this was local, we just have a path argument. We have a bunch of extra stuff here. Okay, so that's sort of our client and server, like what this is equivalent to. So we can see that there's a bunch of extra stuff, but it's still, you know, for a high level, it looks like a function call. And Google RPC's system could have made decisions to make this look more like a function call, but they decided that that wasn't worth it, is basically. So what else is going on here? So one thing you notice is that we have this extra stub thing and this extra context thing. What are those? And these are kind of necessary. These are a price we're paying because we have remote procedure calls. So the stub here is we have to specify what remote machine am I talking to? And the way Google RPC does it is that you set up this stub object with information about what machine you want to contact, and then you call methods of that object to contact that machine. So the stub contains what machine do I actually talk to, and we have to specify that somehow. This context here on the server side is a way to get access to extra information about the call, because there's some stuff that we might end up wanting to know on the server, like maybe we want to look up what client did this come from, or as the code actually here does, maybe you want to signal an error in a special way, and this context gives us a way of accessing that sort of functionality that wouldn't exist if we had just a local procedure call. So then we have some complication which is added because gRPC has made some design decisions that simplify their implementation and cross-language compatibility. And the big one is they've decided that every remote procedure call that they're going to implement takes one argument, which is a struct. Some other RPC systems are more flexible at this. This is just to simplify their implementation and make things, you know, make it easier for them. And it turns out because this is a struct and we could add extra fields, it's not really a big burden for users. At least that's the hope. So then we have this one remaining little thing here, which is that our make directory function that I defined for my server, I had to define it as a method of a Python class here. I know most of you haven't worked much with object orientation in Python. So this here is how I define a class directory_simple that inherits from directory_servicer. So what gRPC did is for their server stubs is they put some of their server stub code in this base class called directory_servicer. And when you want to implement functions that those stubs call, you make a subclass of that and override the methods. Then you make an instance of this class and you're going to pass it to gRPC. And that's how it can find where are the functions that I want this server I'm running to call when clients ask for them. And this self argument here is part of how Python object orientation works. Okay. So questions about what we see in this code here. And I'll talk about sort of what goes on here and also how do we actually start the server, which is something we're missing a bit later. Okay, so we have a real example of how we would use our remote procedure calls. And we can see that in this real example that you know, maybe it's not quite really as convenient as a local procedure call, though it's kind of close. Let's talk a bit about things we have to do when implementing this. And the big thing that I mentioned our stubs are doing is converting arguments to bytes and back and return values to bytes and back. And this is known as marshaling or serialization. These are just vocab terms for this process of converting values to bytes and back. Back is the opposite of this, unmarshaling or deserialization. And you might say, okay, we need bytes. It's stored in memory as bytes. Just copy the bytes. And that often doesn't work. And there's two big reasons why. So one is things like pointers and references. Sure, a character pointer to a string is just bytes, but if we copy the bytes of the pointer and put it on a remote machine, it's not going to work on the remote machine because the stuff it points to isn't on the remote machine. So we need to do something more intelligent whenever we have some sort of structure that contains pointers. Another issue is that a very common goal of these remote procedure call systems is to work across different architectures. For example, maybe I'm making a mobile app and I want it to access a service on another machine, and my cell phone and that other machine probably use very different architectures. Like they might have 32 versus 64-bit stuff, different endianness, and you know that's going to be another obstacle. We're going to have to like match up between those two machines. And this is usually a goal of an RPC system, is to hide those differences between architectures. So we have to do this marshaling and serialization. And as I said, it's not just copying the bytes. And we're going to generate code to do that. And the question is, what are we going to generate the code from? And you might say, okay, well, you just give me a header file or like a Python file and I look for the defs in it, and that's what we're going to use. And that's typically not the case. Typically, to get this information, the RPC server author writes a separate file just for the RPC system in something called an interface description language, or IDL, that specifies, here are the remote procedure calls I want, here's what types they take, and so on. And this is what's used to produce the stubs, both client and server, along with all that marshaling and unmarshaling code. And you might say, gosh, this seems like an extra step. I need to write the function prototypes anyway. Why don't the tools just use my function prototypes? If I'm writing a server in C++, why don't I just give it my header file and have it figure it out? And that is a real idea that we could probably do. But there's problems with header files versus what the RPC systems need to use. And the big issue is that they're missing information most of the time. So for example, you know, if I have a function, like get item char star, I don't know from that prototype, is that a null terminated character array? What is it? I don't know how big that is. If I have, some function which is, find int star array int size int value, how do I figure out that size is the size of this array and this value is the size of this array? Am I going to guess from the names? We probably want a more precise way of communicating that. If I have a function that takes like a pointer to a list, is that pointer being modified? Is it effectively a return value? Or do I just send it once? I don't actually know that. If I have a function that get returns a string, where is the memory for that string allocated? Does the RPC library need to deallocate that? Does it need to be allocated with new so it can be deleted? We don't have that information. So there's a bunch of stuff that's typically missing from these from these header files, which is one big reason why we're going to have the separate interface description language, that the header file isn't going to have enough information. Now, you might say, it doesn't have enough information, but we could just add some annotations. We could have you have some syntax where you add a specially formatted comment at null terminated. And then we could still use our header files, have everything in one place. And this is not the solution RPC systems have liked. And probably the big reason for it is that they have goals beyond just getting that missing information, that they want to be machine and language neutral. And being language neutral especially means that they would like you to publish something for your RPC server where it doesn't matter that your RPC server is working in C++, I can still use it from, say, my Python program or my Java program. And this means that they want to make one decision about how long your integers are and so on, which is separate from language decisions like how big a long is and so on. Or what a string is formatted as, they're going to have a string type and they're going to map that to appropriate types in every language, rather than having you as a Python programmer get this C++ file and need to figure out what is this string turn into in Python. They're going to define a basic string type and say what that is, and you're going to read that, generic language neutral description. Another big reason, besides this machine language compatibility, is that we need to worry about upgrades. So with a library, we don't typically worry about upgrades that much because our model is that if I update the library, I make new header files, I make a new library file, and you recompile and relink your program. But that's not what's going to happen with these remote procedure calls. I'm going to update my server and my mobile phone that talks to that server, I didn't update it. Maybe I didn't even have an internet connection to update it. And something needs to happen. And for this reason, RPC systems are often very concerned about compatibility. And they want to define precise rules about what's going to happen if the server is running a newer version or the client is running a newer version. And they can design their interface description language to make this clearer than it would be for just a normal header file. And that's sort of a very big concern because that's something that, we're going to do. We're not going to be able to upgrade everything in lockstep, so we need to have an answer for what's going to happen. So questions about these reasons to use an IDL? Okay, so I have this idea of an IDL. So let me show you what a subset of gRPC's IDL looks like. So we define a message, and this you can think of as kind of a struct type, which has a string path. It'll talk, and there's this equals one. We'll talk about that in a second. And we define a service, which is a set of related remote procedure calls. And this has our make directory operation. We say it takes make dir args and returns, it has to return something, it returns empty, which is just an empty struct. So we have our remote procedure call we've seen before, and using this information, the RPC implementation needs to translate this call into something that goes on the network. And one possible implementation, this is not what gRPC does. What gRPC does has a bunch of complicated things like HTTP version 2 that we don't want to talk about. So this is sort of something we could do that sort of illustrates the concepts. So here, we need to send over the network in a way to identify the function. And I've chosen here that we're going to write the name of the function. And I need to say, where is the name end? And I've chosen to do that by prefixing the name with a byte, which is the length of the name. So that's what this XOD is, this a byte, which is the length of the name, make directory. And then I need to write the arguments. And gRPC has this equals one thing. These are field numbers. So the idea is that we might add more things or less things to this message. We can do that. And each one has a number. That also means if I decide, path, that was a horrible name. Let's try file name. I can rename this from path to file name, and it doesn't change what's sent over the network. So over the network, we're sending field number one has this value, and I send here the value has a length 4, and it's slash foo. and I send a length beforehand. That's just a choice I've made. I could have done something else, like null terminating it, but I decided I will send the length beforehand, and this is what I send over the network. So you can see that, you know, I'm using the information up here to produce this message. And also, I've designed this in a way where if I went to add fields, it's pretty clear how that's going to work. Okay. So questions about sort of this hypothetical idea for how we might, you know, take our IDL and translate it into actual messages we send over sockets. Okay. So now that I've done sort of this high level view, let's look into sort of some missing pieces from the gRPC examples I showed before. And then we'll talk about some sort of just at a high level, you know, things that work and don't work well with remote procedure calls. So here's a more complete example of the of an IDL file for gRPC. We can see here I'm defining different structs for the arguments for these two procedure calls I'm defining. One of them doesn't return empty, but returns an actual struct with stuff in it. And we see we have this repeated field, so this is basically gRPC's version of an array inside a struct. And you can see it's repeated of a name and a is directory flag. Each of these has field numbers. This means that later on I could say, decide, oh, is dir is not a good name. It should be, is directory is not a good name. It should be, you know, is dir or something else, or name should be path, or I can change this later on without changing how it's sent over the network if I want to. So this is sort of our example of the file. So we have our messages here. And each of these, when it's compiled to our generated code, turns with gRPC into a C++ or Python class, depending on what you're using. And there's other options for other languages. And these classes have all the accessors and also marshalling and demarshalling, namely convert to and from bytes functions. This is actually a separate library that gRPC uses. So there's something called protocol buffers if you just wanted the marshalling and unmarshalling without any of the remote procedure call stuff. You have these field numbers, as I mentioned, so we can change the field names, add new fields, and not get confused. We have our names of our remote procedure calls. So there's going to be a generated class, directories, servicer, we'll see later, that has, you know, these functions that it wants to be overridden in a subclass. And we have these argument types, and gRPC, to keep things simple, makes it always one argument that's a message, always one return value that's a message. And that's why we had to use this empty type. So that's our IDL. And when we use this IDL, it's gonna, with Python, we're gonna compile this IDL file into a Python file, actually a set of Python files. So here I'm importing two Python libraries called, you know, which were probably, you know, generated from a file called dirproto.proto, which was the IDL file. The question is here is when a new programming language is created, how does gRPC accommodate it? So gRPC, like, they've defined this IDL format. So if you have a new programming language you want to support with it, you need to decide, well, what are strings going to turn into? What are booleans going to turn into? How are you going to represent, you know, a base class or an equivalent? So you just make all those decisions based on what's already in the interface description language. Does that answer your question? And so here I'm showing you what happens for Python, and indeed they support a whole bunch of languages, and probably in some cases they needed to make interesting choices. So here in Python, we have these two Python files of generated code. So basically something ran on the IDL file and produced a bunch of Python code, and I'm importing this Python code. And one of the things the Python code provides is a base class, this directory servicer, That lets me, you know, actually implement my procedure calls by inheriting from it. And another it provides is it provides the actual functions to, in this case, create an instance of the return value type. So that creates a new empty object. See my implementation here. And a more interesting case is where I need to actually return something useful. So here I'm importing the generated sort of structs, our directory list and directory entry struct. So I call the constructor of the directory list type, then I append. So this repeated value was mapped to a Python array. That was the choice that gRPC made for how those repeated values are implemented in Python. And I'm just appending to that and then returning that value. If something goes wrong, I signal an error in this using this context, which the idea is that I could throw an exception, but this will give me an error that makes sense no matter what programming language someone is using for this, using to call me. Questions on this code? So I have this directories impl class, and I've shown you sort of how I implement it. And this is a subclass, but I need to actually create an object of this class and pass it to gRPC. So the way I do that, and I know I'm missing something here that I need to add, is I first create a server object. And when I create it, I pass how I want the server to run my function calls. And in this case, I'm telling it, make a new thread pool to run the function calls with 3 worker threads. And basically what gRPC is going to do is when the server is running, it's going to queue something on this thread pool every time a remote procedure call is made to actually run the call. Then I need to say, okay, I made my directories impl class. Let me add it to this server. And there's this generated code which knows how to do that based on the particulars of what RPC calls need to be set up. Then I tell the server what port number to listen on. So this is the name plus, you know, port, you know, to listen on. I could also specify a local socket, which will do, you know, but this is specifies how the client is going to identify the server. And once we've done all the setup, we say tell the server to start, and it actually runs in a separate thread. This is the server side, so we, you know, tell it how we want it to execute our, you know, procedure calls. We register, hey, here's where I implemented them by giving it a class which has those methods, and then we start it after telling it where its client is going to contact it. From the client side, we're going to need this information here. And what I do is I create what it calls a channel with that information, and we create a stub object. So this is sort of their idea of the client stub using that channel. And then I can call methods on that stub object, which represent the remote procedure calls. And when there's an error, and note that error, you know, could be a network error or just a normal failure. So this error here will be thrown whenever something goes wrong, regardless of whether it's like, couldn't make the directory, or I couldn't contact the server. And you can also see, we can also get a return value. So here's using that call, which had a return value. See, I just iterate through that struct. Questions about these code samples? Okay. So, something to note about what we've seen so far, sort of as conclusions, that like this remote procedure call system, we wanted it to look like local procedure calls. We didn't quite succeed. So the big thing is the setup is not like local procedure calls. You know, with local procedure calls, we link the library, we're done. Here, we have to specify what server, what port. We also had to have a bunch of boilerplate setup code. That wasn't great. There's some other issues. So errors might happen. So what if our connection fails? Network unplugged, bad Wi-Fi. So there's a bunch of new error cases. So new types of errors that don't exist with local procedure calls. We also mentioned that we had to worry about what if the client and server went out of sync. And we had a bunch of stuff we were doing, like numbering fields, so we could handle that situation. And a fourth issue is performance. So I didn't like talk about the performance of this, but if we think about sort of local procedure calls, this is like typically less than 100 nanoseconds, maybe less than 10 nanoseconds for local. And remote ones probably are usually 1 ns plus. Maybe 10 to 100 microseconds if you have a really good network. And I mean exceptionally expensive network. But probably more like a millisecond. That's sort of another big consideration. Is that, yes, we have the same interface, not going to perform the same. And we have these errors, extra work we're doing. But we're kind of close, and it's such a convenient model that it is actually used a lot industrially, which is why Google has a well-maintained RPC system out there. So another thing about it is I talked about using sockets on the local machine. People also use RPC on the local machine. Why? Well, because it's more convenient than pipes. Sounds fine. Something to note is that if you're doing it locally, you could imagine an implementation that's maybe more efficient than using sockets. And that is, in fact, something that sometimes happens. Like you could use mmap a file and put a mutex in that shared memory. Okay. So questions about RPC before we finish up? Talking about RPC. So our next topic, we're going to talk more about these errors. So I mentioned like we have these new types of errors, and we're going to spend a bunch of time thinking about how can we deal with these errors and still make a distributed system work correctly. And it's probably useful to start thinking about like how do these errors, change things we might do with our remote procedure calls. So to think about this, let's first think about how the network fails. So we're going to talk about dealing with both network and machine failures. But I'm going to start with talking about network failures because the network can only fail in so many ways, it would seem. And machine failures are kind of a trickier issue. So let's talk about network failures. And I'm going to just think about two types of network failures. You might say, what about messages being corrupted? We're not going to care about that because we assume we can deal with messages being corrupted by using checksums. So once we've dealt with that, we have two kinds of issues we're going to care about with our networks. One thing is that the network could lose messages. So like I'm sending something on the Wi-Fi, I step too far away, doesn't work. Another case is messages could be delayed or reordered. This is less obvious why this would happen. And there's sort of two common reasons. So one reason is if message lost but resent, that would delay the message and possibly reorder it, sending it after other messages that should have been sent earlier. Another reason is multiple paths. So if I have my client and my server, and I have the network in between, but the network actually has multiple ways to get from the client to the server, and some of my messages go this way, and some of my messages go the other way, well, they'll take different amounts of time. They might not end up in the order I expect. But regardless of the reason, these are the main things we're going to be concerned with our networks. So the question is, like, how do these affect us, and how are we going to make a distributed system operate reliably despite these things happening? I'm going to start with network failures, because if we can't deal with network failures, why do we care about machines failing? So let's say a message gets lost. How can we deal with that? The easiest way is to have what we call acknowledgments. When we send a message, the machine we're sending it to should say, yes, I got it. And if we don't hear, yes, I got it, we retry. Now, you know, this is imperfect. So, for example, sometimes the machine might say, yes, I got it, and the message saying, yes, I got it, is lost. In which case, we'll retry even though we don't have to. Another thing, and that's kind of a preview of what we'll be thinking about when we talk about machine failures, is that if the machine isn't there, well, it just looks like the network failed. They're the same thing as far as we're concerned. We might keep retrying even though there's no one to talk to, even, you know, though the network, you know, is fine. Okay. So since we're thinking about these, you know, messages being lost or reordered, let's think about how this affects our RPC system. So, you know, so I said if a message is lost, we're going to, you know, detect that by waiting for, asking for a response, say, yes, I got it. If it doesn't come here, we can retry until we get one, you know. And kind of a detail here is, how much do we retry? Eventually give up. Let's assume we eventually give up. We don't have to do that, but realistically, you know, we're probably not going to spend, have our program sit for, you know, days. Instead, we're going to say, I think the machine isn't there, or I think the network's not coming back. Let's assume we do that. And this applies to our RPC system. So the sort of simplest implementation of our, say, make directory operation sends a message containing the data for this RPC call. I gave an example earlier of sort of what the bytes might be. And the simplest thing we could do, which doesn't handle failures, is that we send that message and then we're done. So that's our option A here. So that says we have our client and it sends to the server make directory. And when it thinks it sent it, you know, after it thinks it sent it, done. That's our option A. Option B, you might say, okay, option A clearly has a problem. We're clearly, sometimes the network's not going to work, you know, and it's not going to happen. So in this case, we're not going to rely on thinking, yep, I sent it. We're going to check. We're going to have the server return, yes, I got it. So in this model, you know, we're going to say, Victor, the server is going to come back and say, yes, did it, got it. So let's say we only have network failures. So let's not assume that our machines are doing all the right things, but there could be lots of problems in between the machines. And given that, I have sort of two scenarios. So I make my remote procedure call for make directory. It throws an exception. So the RPC system detected that something went wrong, or it throws no exception. I'm asking, with each of these two implementation strategies, in the first case, I threw an exception. Is the directory, was the directory created? Yes or no? Could it have been created, rather? No. Is there a possibility that even though it threw an exception, the directory is there? And in the second case, it didn't throw an exception. Is there a possibility that the directory wasn't created? I'll give you a little time to answer this. Give another 30 seconds or so. Okay, so let's go through these. So for A, so let's go through the majority answers first. So if I call it and it throws an exception, could the directory have been created? Most people say yes, and I think so, yes. Yes, and the simplest way to demonstrate this is let's say this yes, I got it message was lost. You know, acknowledgement... lost, you know, for e.g., you know, network down after, right after creating. So if the network goes down right after you create it, like I unplug the Wi-Fi right after the directory is created, yes, we could get an exception, but the file was really created. With option A, it's a little different. So we have sort of a mix of answers. So here, I think probably it couldn't have been created, but the question is, you know, could we have sent enough to make the directory, but not finish? Directory, but not finish sending. So as long as, if we finish sending, you know, that's definitely enough for the directory to be created, regardless of what happens afterwards. And if it's possible that, like, if we send less than the whole message and we get a failure, maybe that could happen. But I think mostly, probably not. Probably we either, you know, successfully sent it and it could have been created if no failures happen, or we didn't send enough to do the make directory command. But maybe if we like send something afterwards that doesn't actually matter, we could have this scenario where it throws an exception, but the directory is really created. Because remember, the exception is only telling us in option A that we couldn't successfully send everything. And I think probably that means the directory couldn't have been created, but I could imagine like maybe the last few bytes of what we're sending don't matter or something like that. So then we have the case with no exception, and a big majority of you say that if there's no exception, the directory must have been created with could have not been created with A, and this is yes because you know maybe the message didn't get there. Now, with B, some of you said yes. I think no, assuming the server doesn't respond until after creating. The server waits until after it creates the directory, and we didn't get an exception. It must have responded and must have created the directory. Maybe something could be different if the server like responded before it got the whole command or something like that, but hopefully it would be designed not to do that. Okay, so questions on sort of my interpretation of these scenarios. Okay, so we have this idea of dealing with messages being lost by the network, of just retrying. There is a little nit we have to deal with, and this is the same problem we dealt with redo logging, that we're retrying doing the operation, and we need to be careful. And one reason we need to be careful is that some of our operations, we can't just keep appending. So here, let's say I append, ask to append, you know, and I just do the naive thing, I would just send the append message, I don't know whether it's done. So I wait for a reply. Great. But that might be lost. what do I do if it's lost? I don't want to just say append again, because if I do that, now file A contains two copies of the thing I appended, not just one. And this is the same problem we had with redo logging. We wanted to make sure that it was safe to do the things in our log twice. We want to make sure it's safe to do the things we're going to retry until we get an acknowledgement twice. So we're going to retry, you know, in an idempotent way. So we're going to, you know, say append to file A, but say it in a way where we can say append if you haven't already. So have some way of saying, yes, you've already appended. You can imagine multiple ways of doing that. And a detail we're kind of going to gloss over, but a real concern in systems, is that we could keep losing this reply. And we have to give up at some point. And that's just, that's not a good, there's no good answer about when you do that. When do you give up? And what do you assume? Well, we'll talk about things you can assume if you give up, but, you know, what you assume in that case. So this dealt with messages being lost. And I told you the other issue was messages being reordered. So for messages being reordered, we talked about connections. Our connections deal with this. We're going to want to talk about dealing with this manually because the RPC abstraction doesn't, right? If I have two remote procedure calls, they can happen in parallel. So if I think they're supposed to happen in an order, that might not, they might happen in the other order because of things over the network getting reordered. But the way connection protocols deal with this, and a way we can deal with it if we're concerned about it, is with what I'll call sequence numbers. We just number our messages. So if I went to send hello and then world, you know, if I didn't number these messages, I'd say, think I got world hello, but I don't want to do that. The solution is just add numbers. And when we get the messages, we can say, oh, I got part two. I haven't got part one yet. Let me wait for part one. And then when I get both parts, I say, yep, got them both. That's dealing with reordering. So we have a solution for dealing with our problems with the network. So now that we've dealt with our problems in the network, let's talk about how machines fail. And we're going to have a model for how machines fail. And with the network, we could basically say either messages get reordered or lost. With machine failures, that's not really realistic. We know machines fail in lots of ways. But we're going to make a huge simplifying assumption. And this is actually commonly done. So there's basically two models of machine failure. And we're mostly going to use this simple fail-stop model. And in this model, we're going to assume when machines fail, they stop responding and don't get messages. Or alternately, they detect they're broken and just ignore everything. This is easy to deal with because we don't have to worry about like corrupted data. We're just going to assume we can avoid that and just have the machine say, no, I don't know what's going on, rather than like giving us corrupted data or so on. Now, you might say, gosh, I've seen machine fail in like really strange ways. Like, that's not realistic. And I agree with you. And people who need to deal with this have this alternate failure model called Byzantine failures. In that model, the machines do the worst possible thing. Like, they, like, just as if, like, they're controlled by someone who just wants to mess your program up, and they're going to choose the worst possible thing to do. Like, they're going to say, yep, I made that directory and do nothing, or make a different directory, whatever is most inconvenient. Now, you might say, gosh, there should be some point in between. Yeah, there probably should. But it doesn't actually appear much in the literature. And also, gosh, this worst possible thing seems really hard to deal with. Yes, it is. I'm mentioning this model. We're not in this class, I suspect, going to talk much about how we actually deal with it. And in fact, we're going to kind of talk about a simple case for dealing with failure. So I have, here's how my machines fail. And there's sort of two issues we can deal with, talk about handling failures. And one is, if things fail and stop failing, you know, what state is our system in? That's what we're going to focus on. So we're going to focus on dealing with failure. So this is our main topic, and also the last assignment is, let's say a machine fails and we want to recover when the machine comes back up, either the machine fails or the network fails, and we want to get the system back into the correct state without things being confused, you know, avoid confused states when everything comes back up. And you want to avoid confused states even though the machines were working together. So there's an alternate problem here. This is alternate topic, which is continuing to work during a failure. So when I talked about why we do distributed systems, I mentioned this idea of redundancy. And in that idea, we want to still work as long as enough machines weren't failing. And this is indeed a very important topic. I don't think we'll have time to talk about it this semester. That's sort of another set of things. We're going to start just talk about getting things back into a consistent state, you know, when things fail by stopping working temporarily. Okay. And we'll talk about, when we finish up, why is that a little difficult? Think about why that's difficult. I need to talk about sort of things that we'll do with multiple machines. And we're going to have this idea of a distributed transaction. So if you remember, a transaction with redo logging was the idea that we do lots of operations together. And here, a distributed transaction, we're going to do lots of operations as one thing, but the operations are going to be on multiple machines. And our goal in having these distributed transactions is to have a consistent state, that when we do this operation with two machines, that it happens or doesn't, that we don't have an in-between state. So it's the same kind of problem we had with our file systems. If I moved a file from one directory to another, I wanted to end up with a file in the first directory or the second directory, not something in between the two. So our primary goal is to make things consistent. Either it happens or it doesn't, not something in between. Our secondary goal is that if nothing breaks, we want the operation to actually happen. This is to avoid stupid solutions like let's never do anything, which would give us a consistent state, but not be very interesting. And why would we want to do this? So let's give an example I'm going to use a bunch. Let's say I have a course database and I split it across machines. I have some machines which have records for students with a list of courses they're in, and I have records for courses with a list of students. And we want to keep these in sync. So when we want to add a student to a course, I need to update the machine with the record for that student and the machine with the record for that course. And we want there to be no confusion about who's in a course. If I'm doing this and machine C crashes, if it loses power, I don't want the machines to come back up and find out the students in the course on their sys, but not on the professor's sys, which is looking at the course records. I want it to be consistent. And to make this possible, we're going to allow the machines to say no, so you can retry later. So if something fails, we'll say, sorry, can't add you to the course now, try again later. So our naive idea for doing this would be that, let's say on wherever our student record is, let's say it's machine A, we execute code where we ask the machine with the course records, add my student to the course. When the machine C says, yes, I did that, we add the student to the course. So this seems fine in the case of failures, but there's actually a big problem. And that problem, even when there's no failures, is that if we check here, it's inconsistent. Student is not in course if we add course, but on A, but student is in course on C. So even though there's no failures, we already have an inconsistency. And so one thing distributed transactions are going to want to fix is we don't want this inconsistency when there's no failures. And when there are failures, we still don't want inconsistency. So we're going to talk next time about a protocol, a way of communicating between the machines, where we can prevent these inconsistencies And we can do it not only when there's no failures, but when there are failures. So that's where I'm going to finish up today. Any questions before I stop? Okay, doesn't look like it.